From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The U.S. isn't the only country dealing with a drug addiction epidemic, but to reduce the toll of suffering and death, several nations, including Canada, are adopting a controversial approach called safe injection sites. These are clean, supervised places where users can take their drugs, receive fresh needles, access to overdose reversal medications, and connections to treatment services. Safe injection sites are illegal in this country, but half a dozen U.S. cities are considering the idea anyway, saying our current approach toward the opioid epidemic isn't working. Today in The Exchange, we ask how this concept might be received in New Hampshire. It's part of our broader Crossroads project, covering the impact of the drug addiction crisis. You can find out more at crossroadnhpr.org. And let's hear from you right now. Your comments, questions, concerns about this. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Dr. Tim Leahy, physician and ethicist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's also the director at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And Dr. Leahy, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us by phone from Massachusetts is Martha Biebinger. She covers healthcare and other topics for WBUR in Boston. And Martha, welcome back. Good to have you too.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Leahy, to you first, what in your experience treating people with addiction has led you to think that safe injection sites are a good idea? Because as you know, they're pretty controversial.
You know, safe injection sites are controversial in politics, but in science, they're uncontroversial. There's actually really good evidence from Vancouver and other cities that these reduce harm in people who are addicted to drugs. And so I'm impatient to save lives.
So tell us what you see on the hospital floor, you know, day after day that makes you think, I wouldn't be seeing this if we had safe injection sites.
Yeah, it's really been remarkable over the last 5 or 10 years how much our practice in the hospital has changed. Now, just about every day, there's a young person on the infectious diseases service that I run in the hospital periodically who's dying of some complication of injection drug use, in particular endocarditis, infection of the heart valve. And these are, you know, these are people who should be in the prime of their lives, enjoying life, being productive members of our society, who are caught in the grip of addiction and have a preventable complication like this, like an infection of a heart valve or HIV or hepatitis C. And we have ways of protecting them better. And I think we should get through the controversy and just use those measures to save lives.
Why aren't needle exchanges enough? We have those in New Hampshire. You're right on the border with Vermont. They have them there, I believe. So why isn't that good enough?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, drug addiction is a complicated problem. Lots of things feed into it. Economic disenfranchisement, mental illness, just the chemistry of addiction itself. And so there's really no magic bullet, no single solution. But safe injection sites, when coupled with other proven measures like medication-assisted treatment, better mental health access, I think that is a suite of interventions that can actually make a difference.
And you wrote a piece actually talking about the idea of having these supervised injection sites, safe injection sites, whatever you want to call them, in hospitals. How come?
You know, it seems paradoxical. Here we are trying to save lives and protect people from the consequences of bad choices. So you wouldn't think that we would want to have a safe injection site in a hospital. But the truth is that we have people who are struggling with addiction as patients in our hospitals. And when they feel the need to get a fix, they will even leave in the middle of a life-threatening illness to go get it. And that's how tough addiction is to fight. So if faced with the choice of them leaving in the middle of a life-threatening illness to go get high or staying in the hospital to get care and to get high, which I don't want them to do, but to get high in a safe setting, I would pick the latter. Now, there's a third choice that often people gravitate to, which is to just not get high and for them not to be addicted. Of course, we would all want that, but oftentimes that's not possible.
All right. A lot more questions for you on this, especially from the sort of healthcare end of it. But Martha, I want to bring you in too. And Dr. Leahy mentioned something, harm reduction. So just remind us, what is harm reduction? Because safe injection sites are often described by supporters as the next logical step in harm reduction.
Right. Part of this continuum that aims to keep people safe while they're using drugs and keep them alive so that eventually, hopefully, they get into treatment. And Laura, of course, you mentioned needle exchanges. That's one part of it. Distributing naloxone, brand name Narcan, the drug that reverses an opioid overdose, that's another piece of it. People are using test kits now on the streets, asking people to try to figure out what's in the drug they're about to inject before they do so, so maybe they can exercise a little more caution in advance. Supervised injection sites or facilities are one piece of that continuum, and maybe even another one would be prescribing something like heroin to patients on a maintenance level so that you can be sure the quality of the drug they're injecting is safe.
Yeah, I heard about the test kits because we do hear of people dying because they thought they were taking heroin and it turns out there was fentanyl in it, and we all know how deadly fentanyl is. So people are getting test kits, Martha, and then they can find out how safe their drug is. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, it's not foolproof, but yes. The idea is that before you inject, you use a little bit of what's left in the residue of the they call it the cooker, you know, that you've been preparing the drug in to see whether it tests positive for fentanyl. There's growing concern now that there is fentanyl in cocaine. So there's a suggestion you should be testing cocaine if you're using that, even recreationally, because just one hit of fentanyl for an opioid can be deadly, even for people who have a high tolerance for opioids. You know, there are groups that have been suggesting that people who, you know, might take pills at a concert or something should do the same, should test all of these drugs. So you have some idea. And when you do, maybe you would use just a small test dose then before you do the full dose to see if you're going to be okay.
So part of this whole continuum of harm reduction. And Martha, I know that this idea of safe injection sites was talked about in Massachusetts. What happened? And who were the key players in that conversation?
Well, this starts as many harm reduction options do on the streets with people who are drug users and doctors like Dr. Leahy treating people. It's in Massachusetts. It's progressed to the point where the Massachusetts Medical Society is really leading the charge for this. They held a hearing. They held a briefing in Washington, even on Monday, before the Senate, trying to turn up some interest in national legislation. But in Massachusetts, the effort has really stalled with elected leaders, with the governor and the mayors of major cities, because there the worry is that there's not enough evidence that supervised injection facilities or sites will put people on a path to treatment. There's very clear evidence, as Dr. Leahy said, that they save lives. The Vancouver Insight Clinic shows a 35% reduction in mortality deaths over the early period of opening as compared to 9% reduction in deaths in the community beyond where Insight is located in Vancouver. The data is not as strong about putting people on the path to treatment. And that's what a lot of the elected leaders point to.
But it is striking then, Martha, the Massachusetts Medical Society and the Massachusetts Hospital Association both back the idea. But the governor and other top politicians like the mayors of Boston and Springfield said, no way. Is that correct? That's how it sort of is shaken out in Massachusetts?
So the governor is not at no way. He's more at I need to hear more.
Uh-huh.
The mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, is recovering from alcoholism long term. He's obviously very stable. But his approach to addiction is abstinence only. And he's very firm in that. So the idea of a facility in his city where people might come to inject, he's not on board with at all. We are seeing movement in the law enforcement community, which is interesting, though. The the DA of Northwestern Massachusetts, you know, bumping right up against New Hampshire and Vermont there, has come out in support. You're seeing police chiefs say this has to happen. So there's movement, but certainly Massachusetts is not as far along as Philadelphia, Seattle, or San Francisco.
Wow, really interesting. And I want to let folks know that a little bit later in the show, we'll be talking to a local police chief here in the Granite State. I also want to invite your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. I want to ask both of you about a big concern that comes up with this again and again and again. And Dr. Leahy, to you first, the idea that this normalizes taking dangerous drugs, even supports it, even encourages it, and that that's just something we as a society shouldn't be doing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's an understandable concern, but it's really unrealistic. You know, if you think about it, the reason why people inject drugs is not because there is a safe injection site. They've been doing that for years before they ever come to medical attention, and the reasons for their addiction are really not in our control. It has to do with the difficulties of childhood or the sort of the chemistry of their brain. So we don't have control over whether they're addicted or whether they first came to be exposed to the drugs. But now that they are addicted, they're going to use the drugs. And so the thing we do have control over is whether they'll use them safely or not. And if we provide clean needles, a safe space, access to treatment, then we can actually help them get better. Whereas if we just say, well, come back to me when you're abstinent, they'll come back in a coffin.
Well, when you mentioned treatment, that's something Martha touched on. And some questions, Dr. Leahy, around, you know, how much people struggling with addiction take advantage of treatment services when they come to safe injection sites. So what do we know around that?
Yeah, I agree with Martha. The evidence is very clear that safe injection sites can reduce harm in a number of ways. But getting people who struggle with addiction to access services, treatment for addiction, is difficult. And that particular measure hasn't been shown to be associated, although it may. I think that the analogy here would be to say that if I have a drug, say aspirin, that saves lives after heart attacks, but I don't know yet if it also saves lives after heart failure, would I not use it to save lives after a heart attack? Of course I would. And I think the same analogy here applies. We know that safe injection facilities are associated with good things, and we should give those good things to our communities.
Well, lots of conversation about this on our Facebook page. And Frank on Facebook says, this is definitely a good thing, a step in the right direction, in my opinion. Megan agrees. She says, everyone who is struggling with addiction has family and friends and want to keep them safe. It's not encouraging or enabling behavior. Megan says the behavior would happen regardless. Be kind to people, she says. Try to get them help and keep them alive in the meantime. So some folks saying, you know, we should do this. But then here's John on Facebook, who raises a point that some others raised as well. He says, last year, NPR ran a piece on Germany doing the same thing. The key to why it should be funded was that it requires addicts to interact with state-funded employees who could get them help if they wanted it. John says, I think, for one, we should look at their results, and two, we shouldn't spend a dime on this unless we have the capability of connecting addicts with long-term treatment. And Martha, to you, again, I think this was part of the conversation in Massachusetts that some people said, let's not spend time and resources on this. Let's focus 100% on treatment. So what can you tell us there, Martha?
What the advocates of supervised injection sites would say, Laura, is that you can't connect people with treatment until you establish a relationship with people, until you establish trust, until they understand that by coming to you, they're not going to be automatically tossed into jail or judged or shamed for the behavior that they're engaging in. So in Boston, we have something that's a little bit of a hybrid. It's a room where people can go after they've already injected or ingested drugs and then be monitored during their high to be sure that they don't overdose. And what the doctors and nurses in the facility are finding is that by establishing daily contact with people. They get to know them. They get to understand, what have you tried before? What's worked? What hasn't? What other medical conditions might be getting in the way of you moving on to treatment for your addiction? They're starting to treat all of the injuries that Dr. Leahy referenced earlier, the infections, the abscesses, the maybe broken limbs or sprained arms from going out on an overdose. There are many types of medical care that people need. And once they start to engage with the medical community and get help for those things, that's often another step to treatment. So it's the idea that once you have trust in a relationship, you're going to move on. If you don't have that, it's very hard to get people into treatment.
Well, last question for you, Martha, and then we'll let you go. What do you expect to happen next in Massachusetts? As you've been telling us, you know, there was this discussion. A lot of the medical community said yes. Some of the politicians were a little bit nervous. Law enforcement is kind of, you know, looking at this with some interest, but also concern. So what happens next in the Bay State?
There's an effort to get a pilot project into a bill that may be rolled out in May. And if that happens, you know, we would start to look more seriously at a community that would actually be willing to open one of these facilities. That, of course, brings in a level of, do you want it in your neighborhood? And that's a different level of discussion.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about that with our police chief a little bit later in the show. Martha, it's really good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Martha Biebinger. Again, she covers healthcare and other topics for WBUR in Boston and updating us on some of the conversation in Massachusetts about whether to adopt the idea of safe injection sites. As we've been saying, these are places where addicts can use drugs with clean needles, access to overdose medications. A controversial idea, but our guests are telling us several cities in Canada and other countries are doing it already. A couple cities in the U.S. are looking at going ahead with this, including Philadelphia and Seattle. We're taking your comments, questions, and concerns. You can contact us on Facebook. It's NHPR Exchange. Or Twitter, same place, NHPR Exchange. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Leahy, again, to John on Facebook's point, it's one that comes up a lot. Why are we spending resources, attention, time on this approach? Why not just dump our 100% effort into treatment?
I think it's important in controversial conversations like this to focus on common ground. And John raises a really important point, which is we want people who struggle with addiction to have access to the best therapy possible. There is no disagreement there. We all want that. What I would suggest is that we offer treatment to people. We make it easily available. We support that treatment. And we avoid false dichotomies. So, for instance, if somebody is not willing to engage in treatment, would I still be willing to give them a safe place to inject to try to help avoid some of the lethal consequences of their addiction? Of course. Those are the sons and daughters of my community, and I want to protect them. Would I be even happier if they also accessed treatment? Of course. We all would. There's no reason to make a choice between those two.
What incentive is there to access treatment if you've got a nice, clean, safe place to inject?
Most people who struggle with addiction will tell you that if they could get clean, they would. It's just difficult to do. And having a safe place to do it without fear of being attacked or an overdose is at least a way to stay alive until they can get clean another day.
Lots more to talk about, and we'll keep taking your questions and comments. Thanks for all the Facebook comments. Again, you can contact us on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, the chief of police in Franklin, he's got questions and concerns about the idea of safe injection sites. All that's coming up. Stay with us.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, safe injection sites, what they are and whether they help or hurt people with drug addiction. It's part of NHPR's broader Crossroad project covering the impact of the drug addiction crisis. You can learn more at crossroadnhpr.org. And let us know now what you think about this concept of a supervised injection site or a safe injection site. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour is Dr. Tim Leahy, physician and ethicist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's also the director of education at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And joining us now on the phone is the Chief of Police in Franklin, David Goldstein. And Chief Goldstein, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you.
Well, what is your broad thought on this increasing interest in this country on supervised injection sites?
Well, that's a very good question. And quite frankly, when I was approached by your producer to come on your program, I really had to sit down and think a great deal about this. I had heard about these centers or sites in Europe, but wasn't really aware of what was going on in the United States until I started to do a little bit of research. And I've spoken to my colleagues about this as well. And quite frankly, at this point in time, we are in the middle of how do we feel about this? Do we agree with this? Do we disagree with this? And so on. And what we often find ourselves doing is trying to figure out what are the what-ifs that go along with this. What if something happens? What if this happens? And so on. So we're a little bit, I won't say confused, but we're a little bit in the middle of trying to discover how we feel about this and what impact it'll have on our communities.
Sure, and it's a new conversation in this country. What are some of the what-ifs, Chief Goldstein?
Well, for example, in doing some of the research and talking to individuals about these sites, we know that it's an effort and an initiative to try to save lives, which we are fully in compliance with. We do agree with that. However, at the same time, research has indicated that there are a lot of behaviors that surround these sites. Criminal behavior, for example, assaults, rapes, robberies, things like that of individuals that are involved in these behaviors. Looking at the Canadian example, realizing that I believe it was Vancouver had to assign 90 additional police officers to one of their sites in order to reduce crime. And certainly they saw a drop in crime, but I don't know any police department in the state of New Hampshire that has the ability to assign 90 police officers to a particular site. So these are some of the things that we're curious about. And certainly we'll work with the legislature and anybody else that's interested in order to try to come up with a solution.
What about that, Dr. Leahy, the concern that has been cited by Chief Goldstein, but also from many other people, that having a safe injection site would increase crime?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, it's a great example of one of the things that we really do need to think through as communities to make sure that we get this right. In part, the data from Vancouver speak to this optimistically. They saw dramatic reductions in the amount of public drug use that was happening. People were able to get out of the public eye into a safe space to do this. But absolutely, you're going to sort of flush some of the activity that surrounds injection drug use out of the bushes into the popular space. I think that's ultimately a good thing because it allows law enforcement to see it and respond more effectively. And my guess is that the kinds of activity that they saw in a large city like Vancouver are not going to be seen in our small towns, but certainly it'll draw on law enforcement resources, and I think it makes sense to think about this. The way I see this is that injection drug use is already associated with crime, and it's already associated with loss of life and the spread of infectious diseases. And if we can come up with evidence-based ways of reducing those harms, even if they take some extra effort on our part and some community conversations, that's a legacy we want to leave behind for our children. Saving lives, that's good job satisfaction.
Well, and it's interesting to talk about crime. I'm glad you raised it, Chief Goldstein, because some people are saying, look, having these safe injection sites helps reduce the sort of social nuisance costs of addiction, you know, needles left around on the streets. Somebody found a needle in the stacks at the Concord Public Library. My goodness, people shooting up in public places. In the Denver Library, somebody died in the bathroom of an overdose. So there's sort of the crime issue at a possible safe injection site. But then there are these other crimes that are kind of spilling out from addiction all over. I wonder what you think about that, Chief Goldstein.
Well, again, certainly. And we've had our share in Franklin. We had an individual overdose in the Hope building, the Hope for Recovery building, that we had to respond to. We've found needles in our library. And, of course, you're talking about the smallest of the 13 cities, so we can certainly extrapolate that to larger communities. The other thing is that in law enforcement, we also have a responsibility to the community to try to detect, investigate, and subsequently prosecute law breakers. And what happens, at least from what I can see here, is that individuals bring their drugs to the injection site and are then supervised and treated if necessary for any overdoses and what have you. Well, what about those drugs? Where did they come from? Can we, in fact, trace that back to a larger scale dealer? Can we find out? Can we stem the tide, so to speak? And sometimes well-meaning initiatives, and again, we're not objecting to this, we just want to work with everything we have, well-meaning initiatives will oftentimes throw up a roadblock that we can't cross. So we see things today like the Good Samaritan law, which in some cases prohibits us from finding out where the drugs came from that somebody almost or could have died from. So these are some of the issues as well.
Sure. So, yeah, if you're, you know, your job is to prosecute crime, and right now it's a crime to possess heroin and sell heroin. So your concern is, as a police chief, how do I approach a potential place in my town? That seems to be what you're saying. You know, Dr. Leahy, the federal government has made it quite clear that these are illegal. So how would local law enforcement deal with that?
It's a great question, and it gets down to how aggressively do we enforce our laws. We know that we don't ticket every person who speeds on, you know, 2 miles an hour above the speed limit on the freeway. We look for the most egregious offenders and target them. And I think here is a good example to use our laws wisely. As Martha Biebinger said, you can't get somebody to access treatment if you're not in relationship to them. And so if we can form safe spaces that people know they can go to get help and to be protected from the dangers of addiction, that opens that conversation, opens relationship. And we can do creative things, for instance, like law enforcement, like firehouses have done in Gloucester, Mass., where they'll accept without any consequences the paraphernalia and drugs that people are using, people who want to get clean. I think if we reach a hand out like that and say, yeah, we're going to prosecute if we see that you're dealing drugs or whatever, but also there are safe spaces you can come and try to start a new chapter in your life. I think that's the way we balance proper policing of crime, as Chief Goldstein and others are trying to do, and also opening the door for people to get treatment that they need.
Well, both of you, lots of people with questions for you. So let's go back to our listeners. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. We want your questions, comments, concerns about the idea of supervised injection sites for drug users. This is a concept still illegal in this country, but that some other countries, including Canada, are using. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And both of you, let's go to Albany, where James is on the line. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I want to thank the doctor and the chief. And I want to preface everything by apologizing to the doctor. I don't want to kind of come out in a way. I'm a firefighter paramedic, and I work with not necessarily the Franklin chief, but a lot of officers. My question would be kind of, I have a question and a comment. Mine would kind of be first out to the chief to see his thoughts. I've responded to the same address, same patient, multiple times in a 24-hour shift, administering Narcan for an overdose. Want to kind of pose the question is, could we do something, or his thoughts on it, to some sort of monetary fine for doing that, to kind of recoup some of the some of the monies that are lost as far as resources, both medicinal and manpower-wise, and then maybe do something where if you don't pay the fine, you know, then it revolves into, you know, you're going to the court, then in turn you could do jail time for not paying the fine, and using that as maybe a way to help, you know, kind of people get off the streets, get clean, and get sober. And then the second part would be more of a comment the doctor just touched on, firehouses, you know, no questions asked, dropping off paraphernalia. Does he think that maybe those are the users that we should maybe more focus on getting the help and spending more money with them, because they are taking a very large first step to, you know, recovery at that point, rather than trying to throw money and time and resources at these people who are just going to, you know, relapse or keep abusing or supplement their use with the methadone or Suboxone and pills and heroin?
Well, James, thank you so much for the questions, and we'll get our guests to answer them for sure. And I just want to thank you for all the work that firefighters have done on this. You guys are really doing your best, and we all really appreciate it. So thank you for calling in. And to you first, I think, Dr. Leahy, what about the question that he asked about, you know, should we focus more on people who are coming to the safe stations, who are saying, you know, help me out?
Yeah, let me just add my thanks to you, James, and the other first responders. I think you raise a really important point that people who have reached out for help are the ones who are most likely to benefit from it. So we certainly want to be there for them. It's also important for us to know that it's hard to know who's going to benefit the most. We all also have anecdotes of people who we've been surprised by, but wow, thank God they turned around. So for me, I think the best thing is to hold the hand of help out to anyone and have optimism, but also to understand that if on that day they're not ready to accept the help, it's okay, I'll be there another day.
Well, and to you, Chief Goldstein, what do you think about James's powerful point? Wow, responding sometimes several times within one shift to the same person who's overdosing. And he's asking, you know, what ideas you have to kind of break the cycle there.
Well, and that's a very good question, and I work very, very closely with my fire chief, and both of our departments work closely relative to this, as well as any other issue. The difficult part there for law enforcement would be that a lot of the individuals we do deal with, and we in Franklin respond just the way that the firefighter paramedic, excuse me, paramedic EMT was talking about, to the same address, same individual over and over again. A lot of these individuals, first of all, are very poor, quite frankly, don't have financial wherewithal to be able to pay fines. Secondly, a lot of these individuals are very transient. So we might see them in one address today and at another address tomorrow. And we're not so sure. We acknowledge the reality that we can't arrest our way out of this problem. So we want to work with all of the agencies that we can in order to try to stem the tide again. But certainly, and the legislature right now in another venue is looking at bail reform. And for us to bring people into and introduce them to the court system would actually run counter to some of what bail reform is trying to do. So it's a really complex issue. And quite frankly, while we've talked about this on occasion, the fire chief and I, we both recognize the fact that, unfortunately, at this juncture, it's not going to work.
Okay. Well, James, thank you again for the call. The number for you to join us with your comments, questions, or personal experiences like James, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And both of you, let's go to Susan in Manchester. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. It's question and comment and question. It's my impression that many drug users are not so much looking to get high as they are to ward off the pain of withdrawal. And then my question is, are there some studies currently in play that are measuring the percentage of safe site users getting into treatment?
Yeah, two great questions. Thank you so much, Susan. And to you, I think, Dr. Leahy, that second question first, we touched on it earlier, but how much do we know about that strong connection or not between safe injection sites and treatment? I mean, that's the issue, partly.
Yeah, safe injection sites have clearly been shown to have benefits. And so I believe as a public health practitioner, as a physician, that the evidence is good enough to use them now. but it would be even better to know that they also helped us connect people to needed care. It's a very difficult question to ask because, of course, if somebody accesses the safe injection site at my hospital, they might access services at another hospital, and I might not know to be able to measure it. So I know that places like Vancouver's Insight program are attempting to measure this, but I would anticipate it's going to take years. The reason is that it takes time for people to access care. It takes time for us to be able to measure them. And frankly, addiction drug use is a very, very difficult thing to move the dial on. And so it takes time to be able to count up the way we've made a difference.
Well, Susan, thank you for the call. And here's an email that came in from Dean, who says, during the 2016 study commission for a syringe access bill that passed in 2017, allowing syringe services programs in New Hampshire, Tufton Borough Police Chief Andrew Shigorny represented the NHACOP, and I guess, Chief Goldstein, that is the New Hampshire Association of Chiefs of Police. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. So Dean says that that Chief Shigorny said of safe consumption spaces, quote, they would solve a lot of problems, but politically they wouldn't work. Dean asks, is there a disconnect between the science and the politics of SCSs, and what can law enforcement do to make SCSs more politically viable? SCSs meaning safe consumption sites, safe consumption spaces. What do you think, Chief Goldstein, about that statement? They would solve a lot of problems, but politically they wouldn't work.
Yeah, again, the town fathers, the politicians there who are in charge of our municipalities, my experience with that so far has been relatively negative insofar as not in my backyard type of attitude. I think that from a law enforcement point of view, we have to continue to sally forth and do our jobs. And at the same time, we do have influence, if you will, within our own communities to try to make change and show or demonstrate to our politicians, our legislators, that in fact this is or is not working, depending on how it eventually works out. And I certainly appreciate the doctor saying that this is going to take years. This is not going to be an overnight type of fix. And by the time this does come to pass, we're going to see a much younger cohort of politicians in power in our cities, towns, and our state level. So I don't have a good answer for you, Laura, on that one, but certainly law enforcement would be in tune with trying to make that change and influence things for the better.
Well, last question for you, please, Chief Goldstein. The mayors of Boston and Springfield, as we heard earlier, have both said, no, we don't think this is the way to go. We think public efforts and money should go toward treatment. What do you think about that? Again, Chief Goldstein is someone who's on the front lines.
Well, again, and I'm an eclectic kind of guy, so I try to look at everything and see what will work and perhaps what won't. I'm familiar with what the mayor of Boston said, and I also have to believe that a lot of that is community influence that came to his office. Individuals who do not want this, I can't say that for sure, but that's my best guess with that. So we do see that our politicians, our leaders, have to follow what the recommendations and the suggestions are from their constituents. Again, law enforcement, we're willing to try, but we certainly are not going to abrogate our role as law enforcement officers. We do have a final responsibility to the community and to provide public safety and protection, et cetera, for our communities.
Chief Goldstein, you've been really generous with your time, and it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, anytime.
That's Franklin Chief of Police David Goldstein. And coming up, we'll talk to a reporter who looked at the possible epidemic of epidemics that can arise when lots of addicts use dirty needles. All that plus your questions and comments. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, what does the Secretary of State's office do, both here and in other states? We'll find out more tomorrow on The Exchange, so join us for that. This hour, we're looking at the emerging debate over safe injection sites and the question of whether they help or hurt those struggling with drug addiction. And let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We've been hearing from lots of voices on this topic. With me for the hour, Dr. Tim Leahy, physician and ethicist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, director of education at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And Dr. Leahy, right back to our listeners, and Robert's in Keene. Hi, Robert. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Sure. Go ahead, Robert.
I'm a physician assistant at a mental health and detox hospital, the Brattleboro Retreat in southeast Vermont, but we're really close to New Hampshire. We see patients from all over New England. And so I'm right up there, and specifically I'm working with the medical needs of our patients. And so we see Hep C on a day-to-day basis, one of the main risks of IV drug use, and especially if patients don't have access to clean needles, which even in Vermont, where it's legal to for pharmacists to provide clean works, not always easy to get. There's often one pharmacy per town that will provide them, I'm told by my patients. And the hepatitis C, which is easy to contract if you don't have a clean needle, is very expensive to treat. Tens of thousands of dollars for, there are new treatments, so it's much more treatable. But tens of thousands of dollars per course of treatment, and it can be recontracted after it's treated if somebody relapses, which unfortunately is common. And there's one other complication of treatment that I've seen. I've been in this area of practice for about 4 years, and about 2 years ago, I believe, both New Hampshire and Vermont Medicaid stopped paying for an inpatient opiate detox. If somebody's quote-unquote only problem is their opiate addiction, I cannot bring them into my hospital for a detox. They have to have some other reason, like alcohol or feeling suicidal, to meet level of care for an inpatient detox, which really limits their options for getting out of the situation that they're in.
Well, Robert, thank you for the call. Yeah, and I am familiar with the work of Brattleboro Retreat for sure. Real quick, Dr. Leahy, I'm not sure how much you work with the payment side of things, but I'm guessing that's an obstacle for your patients.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point. I think the way to think about it is that there is no way for our society to avoid paying the price of addiction, whether that's sons and daughters of our communities overdosing in their beds, or whether it's the $30,000 to $50,000 per year for every case of HIV infection that we need to treat, or the approximately $100,000 for the drugs alone it takes to cure hepatitis C. We are paying those costs now, and those costs are growing as the opioid epidemic explodes. So I think I completely agree. Our expenditures to try to prevent death and illness from addiction, such as through safe injection facilities, is money well spent.
Well, Robert, I'm glad you called, because we have now with us on the line Ella Nilsson, former Concord Monitor reporter, who now works for Voss, and she's looked at the issues that you raised, Robert, investigating the possible epidemic of epidemics from continued use of dirty needles. Ella Nilsson, thank you for being back with us. We really appreciate it.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So what is this epidemic of epidemics, Ella?
Absolutely. So I think the drug crisis is often talked about as, you know, we often use the term heroin epidemic or opioid epidemic. But as I was talking to doctors and public health officials in states like New Hampshire and West Virginia, which is also struggling with a huge opioid problem, I think a lot of people were saying epidemic is not, it's not big enough of a term to define everything that's going on, because it's not just the problem of addiction. This is creating this whole host of other problems, like the caller earlier mentioned hepatitis C, the possibility of HIV, and then all of these other bacterial infections that just come with injecting drugs, whether that is opioids, heroin, fentanyl, or something like methamphetamine, crystal meth. Just the basic infections that people get from day-to-day injecting drug use, whether that's dirty needles, water that they're using, whether, you know, the tools that they're using are not sanitized properly, even if they're not taking pains to, you know, sanitize their skin with alcohol before they're injecting, these things really matter for safe injection use. And, you know, your average person that is caught up in the cycle of addiction and is injecting drugs, you know, certainly may not always be thinking of the safest way to inject drugs. And there's huge consequences, as the caller mentioned, in terms of costs, in terms of the diseases that it's producing, and just day-to-day infections that people can get.
So, and one of the doctors that was quoted in your story, Ella said, and it's a powerful story, we've got a link on our website, says, look, the number of overdoses does not convey the full scope of the tragedy that's playing out in front of us. That's a quote from your story. And that's what you're looking at, is the both, you know, human suffering associated with hepatitis C, HIV, all these other infections that can happen when people don't use drugs safely. But you did write also, Ella, a lot about the cost of these illnesses. So let's go there a little bit more. How much money are we talking about?
Well, I think that there's this debate playing out in, you know, I'm down in Washington, D.C. right now, and there's this debate playing out in Congress about sort of how much money it takes to really treat addiction and treat the opioid crisis. And Congress just approved in its most recent budget that just passed last week, I think there's $6 billion in there. And the experts that I have talked to pretty much all agree that that doesn't even come close to scratching the surface. I mean, earlier this year, there was talk about maybe $45 billion. I think one of the experts that I talked to, a Harvard economist, you know, approximates the cost at being upwards of $160 billion. If we really want to comprehensively treat not just the addiction and try to get people into treatment and try to prevent future cases from happening, but now, as we have this quote unquote epidemic of epidemics, we have to account for the costs of treating hepatitis C or something like bacterial endocarditis, which, you know, you guys at NHPR have reported on. That was something I reported on in my story. You know, the caller was talking about the costs to treat hepatitis C, and that there are some different drugs now, and there are some cheaper drugs that are available. I think it, you know, can range anywhere from, say, maybe, you know, 20,000 to 90,000 per person to treat hepatitis C. When you're talking about things like bacterial endocarditis, which is when somebody is injecting drugs and, you know, can get bacteria injected into their bloodstream, if there's a buildup of bacteria or if they are injecting with dirty water or other things that get infected, if that travels all the way to their heart, you know, there's a possibility that they could have a stroke. And there are numerous cases in New Hampshire and other states where people need to have open heart surgery. And that's
costs expensive.
Anywhere from,
yeah,
from $100,000 to $200,000. And there is no guarantee that one open heart surgery will be enough for people if they cannot, you know, stay clean. So it's, I've asked people, is there any way that we can quantify how much this costs on a national level? And I think that that's really difficult to do right now, because there's just not enough data to show exactly how much this is going to cost, but it is a lot of money. And the $6 billion that Congress just passed, you know, Senators Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen, obviously Hassan used to be the governor. She knows this problem very well. They have been two of the most vocal senators in on Capitol Hill saying, you know, $6 billion is a great start, but we need to get a lot more serious about addressing this problem, and it's going to take more money.
Well, Ella, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
That's Ella Nilsson, former Concord Monitor reporter. She now works for Vox. You can look at her piece about the epidemic of epidemics on our website, nhpr.org. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is great. It's NHPR Exchange. And Dr. Leahy, back to our listeners. Tom joins us from Rye. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. It's Tom Sherman. I've been on your show before, back when we were looking at Medicaid expansion. I was a state rep. I'm also a liver specialist in Exeter at Core Gastroenterology. And my comment is that I have many patients coming in with acute and chronic hepatitis C. They're very young. they're early in the process of their disease and have no evidence of liver damage. And because of the expense associated, which can be up to $90,000 for a single 12-week course, basically $1,000 a pill, New Hampshire Medicaid will not pay for treatment unless they have evidence of end organ damage, which would be fibrosis or cirrhosis. What that means is that these patients remain contagious and remain infected until we can prove evidence that their liver is actually being affected. And as Dr. Leahy would probably agree, that can be up to 3 decades.
So you're seeing this epidemic of epidemics that Ella Nilsson wrote about, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. This week I had another patient, last week with acute hepatitis C. Actually, that was this week, and last week I was seeing another young patient with chronic hepatitis C. And patients who have gotten clean and are sober now and are unable to access treatment, it's sort of the last vestige of their addiction, which, just to remind your listeners, is a medical illness. And that's why when you had an earlier caller who was talking about patients who come back in time and time again needing Narcan over and over again, I think if we keep that medical model in our head, it makes it a little easier to be patient with them and understand that they have to be ready for treatment.
Tom, let me ask you real quick, given that you're a doctor and that you've been involved in public policy here in New Hampshire in the legislature, what do you think about safe injection sites?
Well, it's a great question. You know, I think right now, and I share the view that this is a crisis that we really don't have a good concept of. The potential for this to spiral into one of the largest healthcare public health crises in the history of the country, I think, is not an overstatement. And so any innovative answer that can be looked at and possibly implemented is going to be helpful. And I agree 1,000% with Dr. Leahy that the evidence-based studies of the effectiveness of this, that's going to be critical.
Okay. Tom, thank you for calling in. I really appreciate it. And let's go to Mike in Concord. Go ahead, Mike. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned with the placement of these things. I came on in the beginning of it. I didn't hear how many police officers had to be added in Vancouver or wherever it was. But when these great ideas come forward, so often they're being pushed by a lot of different people. And whether they actually have scientifically valid studies supporting them or whether they're just associational studies, in other words, whether they're truly randomized studies to prove that they are very effective is one question. But the other question is where you put them. There will be increased crime. There'll be a degradation of the neighborhoods. And what happens is they always go in working class neighborhoods. And the rationality is, well, we can't have them in all these really upper middle class neighborhoods where the people who are pushing these ideas live. Can't have them there. And then how do we keep them out of our neighborhoods? These the people pushing them say, well, services, that's the ticket. They got to be near, these people have to be near services, so they don't have to be in our neighborhoods. But I'd be a lot more comfortable if the people pushing these ideas would either push to have them put in their own neighborhoods or push to rezone their neighborhoods, because this particular thing, I would think, isn't one where they can pull out the services fraud. These people have to be near services to get homeless services or all these other things they're always argued about.
Sure. And Mike, I'm sorry to cut you off. I've got just about a minute or two left in the show, and I really do appreciate the comment. It's a question that I had, Dr. Leahy. I mean, you know, we're in a time now where people, you know, don't want homeless shelters next door. They don't want a drug treatment center next door. These facilities have had a hard time getting approved. And you've got Mike who says, you know, this is going to come into the lower income neighborhoods once again, he feels. How would you convince a neighborhood to take a safe injection site?
It's a great question. You know, the opioid epidemic doesn't respect boundaries, and basically it is in our backyards. So I'd say that your neighborhood is under siege. In the United States, the wealthiest nation in the world, life expectancy is declining, and public health experts think that one of the major reasons is the opioid epidemic.
Which I find absolutely chilling.
It's stunning. So
after years and years and years of life expectancy going up.
That's right.
But go ahead to address Mike's point, you know, some skepticism that this just won't be thrown in, you know, moderate income neighborhoods, and they don't want safe injection sites in their neighborhoods. They're worried about crime.
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern. And the way I'd approach it is that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That feels like exactly the conversation we could have. What's the wisest place to situate these facilities? What treatment access should they have provided there? How do we do it right? Chief Goldstein is right. There are a lot of details to work out. I think instead of turning around and sort of putting our head in the sand in the face of concerns like that, what we need to do is be galvanized by the deaths that we're seeing in our communities and be resolved that we can overcome these challenges just like other cities have.
So other cities in the United States are looking at this. Again, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Seattle, but it's illegal still in this country, and the federal government has said, you can't do this. What do you think is going to happen next then, given this sort of tension between the feds and some of these local communities?
I think we'll have a combination of innovation from cities like Seattle and Philadelphia that are really eager to move forward because they know the human cost of not acting. And in time, I hope that voters will convince their elected legislators that it's time to stop bloviating and time to do something about our communities.
Well, Dr. Leahy, thank you for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
That's Dr. Tim Leahy, physician and ethicist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, director of education at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Our program today is part of NHPR's broader Crossroad project covering the impact of drug addiction here in New Hampshire. You can find out more at crossroadnhpr.org. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.